You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Before we begin, a content warning. This episode contains discussions of spiritual abuse, manipulation, retaliation, and institutional mishandling of reports related to child abuse. It includes survivor testimony that may be triggering for some listeners. Please use discretion while listening, especially if you're tuning in with children or have experienced similar trauma. If you need support, we've listed resources on our website at spoiledfruitpodcast.com/resources or in the show notes. Your well-being matters. Now on to the episode. Mandy Cavoto, a former worship volunteer at Mile High Vineyard, says the moment she and her husband tried to quietly step away from the church, they received a warning.
The response that we got from Jay was, "You have agreed to say that we have not traumatized you, and if you speak ill of us in the community, we will directly and clearly combat that communication." Like, I have that. I read that email again this morning.
This chapter is about power. Who gets it, how they keep it, and what happens to the people who dare to ask questions. In the past few chapters, we've examined how Vineyard USA responded, or failed to respond, to major scandals in Duluth and Anaheim, and how those decisions exposed deeper fault lines across the movement, from nepotism and spiritual abuse to silencing of LGBTQ-affirming voices. This chapter, we zoom in on the man who now leads the entire movement, Jay Pathak, the National Director of Vineyard USA. Jay is often described as warm, persuasive, even brilliant. A former philosophy student, a gifted communicator, a pastor who makes people feel seen, until they don't. Because according to multiple former staff and members of his own church, that charm also masks something more dangerous, a culture of fear, emotional coercion, and spiritual bypass. Mandy Cavoto, who attended Mile High Vineyard for 7 years with her husband Matt, one of the church's main worship leaders, told me,
If he didn't make half the room cry, he didn't succeed.
And yet, it was under Jay's leadership that Vineyard USA underwent a sweeping reorganization, a top-down consolidation of power launched in the shadow of abuse scandals. Presented as a reform, the reorg instead left many pastors confused, silenced, and stripped of any meaningful say in how their movement was being reshaped. So how did Jay Pathak rise to lead a national movement? What shaped him? And what does the reorg reveal, not just about Jay, but about the DNA of the Vineyard itself? We begin at the beginning. To understand how Jay Pathak came to lead the Vineyard movement, you have to start much earlier, with the kind of story that doesn't usually make it into official bios. Jay was born to a strict Indian father who placed incredibly high expectations on him, academic, cultural, and moral. And when Jay became a Christian, it was a point of serious tension. His father didn't approve, and in many ways never fully accepted Jay's decision. That rejection would cast a long shadow. It may seem like a personal detail, but to those who worked with him, it helps explain a deeper pattern. A man constantly seeking validation from strong paternal figures in ministry. Figures like Rich Nathan, the longtime senior pastor of Columbus Vineyard, and one of the most influential voices in the entire movement. Rich Nathan had a law degree and a reputation for being smart, direct, and sharply protective of his authority. More than one former staff member told me that Rich was known to make people cry in meetings. He was also famously comfortable with legal tools, like non-disclosure agreements. At one point in Vineyard Leadership Institute, or VLI, a training program developed under Rich's leadership, he was quoted as saying that a leader's job is to pin dissenters to the ground. The exact phrasing might sound militaristic, but it wasn't a metaphor. It was a philosophy. Dissent was seen not just as a challenge, but as a threat to order, and it had to be crushed. This was the environment Jay Pathak was formed in. Years later, at Mile High Vineyard in Colorado, some of the same patterns would emerge. The public warmth, the private control, the spiritual language used to suppress emotional responses or call for compliance.
Jay Pathak specifically, he's a pretty charismatic guy. Like, I really liked the way he talked. He has a history or a background in philosophy. So he's kind of he's one of those like good apologists, right? Like, he can sort of make you think in a way you hadn't thought before. And there was always, you always had some kind of emotional reaction, right? Like, I think it was pretty rare to show up and just be like, well, this is a boring sermon, and then eat your muffin and go home.
But over time, that charisma became something else entirely.
His goal was to solicit a response. It wasn't necessarily about preaching the truth or preaching the gospel. It was about, it almost felt like emotional manipulation. Like, he loved talking about trauma, right? He would talk about bubbles, like these bubbles of trauma that surface, and he loved it. He specifically talked about enjoying, like, provoking things in people to make them sort of deal with their stuff, which feels, looking back, that feels really gross.
Jay's sermons weren't just teaching moments. They were designed to get a reaction, an emotional one. And that emotion became a form of control, especially when paired with language about your past, your wounds, your relationship with God, and especially when things started to go wrong. That's when Jay's nice guy persona gave way to something else. When Mandy and her husband Matt first joined Mile High Vineyard, it felt like a breath of fresh air. Mandy was a lifelong churchgoer, a musician raised under the piano while her mother played in worship services. So when she found a church that felt younger, more creative, more emotionally alive, she was all in.
What I really liked about the Vineyard was it felt a little bit more progressive. The longer we were in it, I think that probably wasn't as true as I thought it was, but everybody was younger. The musicians are really talented. I grew up in a family of musicians, and I married one, so the fact that the music was so good was always nice.
But behind the emotional impact of the sermons and the glossy presentation of the worship experience, there was another dynamic slowly emerging, one that Mandy didn't fully recognize until much later. Jay's charisma made him seem like the kind of leader you could trust. He was warm, approachable, philosophical. But that public persona could shift the moment you pushed back. Mandy and Matt were longtime volunteers. Matt led worship almost every week, often more than the paid staff. But when they began raising concerns about burnout, about being stretched too thin, about feeling overlooked, the reaction wasn't pastoral.
We felt like the church was using him. He was on stage as much as, if not more than, the paid worship pastor. And we were not being paid at all. And so when we started bringing up concerns like, at least let us be at just one location, those kinds of things, and I would like to also be involved, like, the response that we got was pretty violent.
That shift from warmth to retaliation was swift. It started when Mandy opened up to another worship leader, someone she trusted, about feeling hurt and unseen. That conversation was immediately reported back to leadership. And then things escalated.
And then I got an email from the executive pastor saying, we had been talking about how you're hurt, but now you're hurting other people. And we're going to start switching this from conversations about how we can help you to, basically, she said, we're edging on church discipline. And she said, you're no longer invited to, we were invited to a worship leader event that happens in Cannon Beach. It was a regional worship event in Oregon. And she said, you're no longer invited to this because we're not sure that you can contain your emotions.
The message was clear. Mandy wasn't just expressing pain. She was becoming a liability. And in the Vineyard model of leadership, that meant exclusion. Leadership reframed Mandy's emotional distress as sin. They labeled her verbal processing as gossip. They removed her from leadership spaces. And then they went even further.
When we were going through all this, I actually they told me that I had to have a list of people that I was allowed to speak to. So, you know, and they wanted to know who that was. And I had to give them permission to also be able to speak to that person to hear what I was saying about what had happened to us. And then on top of that, they requested access to my personal counselor to be able to hear what I was saying to him about what was going on at the church. Now, of course, my counselor is not going to allow that to happen. And I actually did draw a line in the sand, like, I'm not doing that.
She refused. But that request, combined with mounting pressure, was a turning point. Still, Mandy and Matt stayed in the church for 2 more years, trying to make it work. They loved the community. They loved the music. They believed, on some level, that things could get better. But when Mandy finally escalated her concerns to someone higher up, Jay's wife, Danielle Pathick, she was told that Jay, quote, doesn't do pastoral care. Instead, Mandy was punished for even using the word violated to describe her experience. In a meeting shortly after, Jay confronted her.
And we went to a meeting where Jay yelled at me for saying that. He's like, these people bleed on the road for you, and you have the audacity to say that about them.
And then came the most chilling moment of all.
When we did finally say, like, we're not going to be part of this church anymore. This is too painful. The response that we got from Jay was, you have agreed to say that we have not traumatized you. And if you speak ill of us in the community, we will directly and clearly combat that communication. Like, I have that. I read that email again this morning.
That wasn't a pastor offering care. This was a pastor issuing a threat. Jay Pathick didn't stumble into leadership. He was handpicked. He had the charisma, he had the platform, and most importantly, he had the backing of powerful men who helped shape the modern Vineyard movement. Men like Rich Nathan of Columbus Vineyard and Michael Gatlin of Duluth. Both Rich and Michael had a clear vision for what leadership should look like. Performance-driven, tightly controlled, and emotionally persuasive. Jay fit the mold perfectly. As pastor of Mile High Vineyard in Denver, Jay built a growing multi-site church, spoke at national conferences, and helped train new leaders. By the time the search began for a new national director, it was already obvious who the next leader would be. There was no real competition, no vote, just quiet consensus. And when Jay stepped into the role, the shift was immediate. He launched what became known as the Reorg, a sweeping restructuring of Vineyard USA's leadership and governance. It was pitched as a necessary evolution, a response to stagnation and pastoral burnout. But for many pastors, it felt more like a consolidation of power wrapped in the language of crisis. Reagan Wagoner, who was pastor of Sugarland Vineyard at the time, remembers the moment clearly.
I did meet with a vineyard leader who said that Vineyard wouldn't last longer than a year unless we took these emergency actions. And emergency actions were used as a license for just arbitrarily controlling, you know, our infrastructure, because we had to, right? It was a crisis, so we have to do something.
To make the case, Jay's team circulated a document called Facts Are Our Friends. It painted a dire picture: aging pastors, declining churches, and a shrinking movement. But beneath the surface, the solutions being proposed weren't objective truths. They were assumptions. Assumptions about identity, growth, and control. And when pastors started to push back, they were met not with dialogue, but with dismissal.
So I made an accusation against Jay that went to a body within the vineyard that most vineyard pastors did not know existed and had no say. They were appointed by the national director. So what could go wrong to have a group, a body appointed by the national director to arbitrate accusations against him? And I said, yes, I would like to tell my story. Here's my conditions. I would like to have a disinterested third party in our conversations, because I don't want anything misrepresented about what's going on, because there's a lot of that going on. So I don't want anything. And they sort of mocked me on it a little bit. Like, what do you mean? And Tom volunteered to be the disinterested third party. What part of... So they said no, they wouldn't do it. And I said, okay, I will come your way a little bit. Here's my second offer. Have each party present their full account of what happened. I'll submit mine along with the emails that I got in return, and that those be included in the report. I'll do it if we do that. I never heard back until I got their final report saying that they had found that Jay was not in any error because they had talked to Jim and they had talked to Joel. That was enough. My executive pastor, they had asked to talk to as well. My executive pastor said, I won't do it without a disinterested third party. And they sort of mocked us in that email. And in that email, let me see, there were several names they called me in that email. They said I was emotional. They said I was lacking self-awareness. They said I was defensive, hypersensitive, and exaggerating. And they said, without self-awareness, it's unlikely that the defensiveness will dissolve as Reagan continues to look outwardly as a victim and less inwardly to what changes he can make better to better a situation. This was their official report. So they had refused to investigate this matter with reasonable protections in place to ensure any kind of fairness. They refused. They never addressed the actual charge that I presented regarding what Jay had done, except just in generalities. And they impugned me and attacked my character.
What was happening wasn't a break from Vineyard's past. It was a continuation of it. The same patterns we saw in Duluth and Anaheim: silencing dissent, centralizing authority, reframing criticism as disloyalty, were now being played out at the highest level. And the reorg? That was just the beginning. Jay's understanding of leadership wasn't just learned, it was strategic, even transactional. Reagan recalled a moment early in Jay's tenure as national director that revealed a lot about his approach to power. The moment didn't happen in a boardroom, it happened on a golf course.
Pastors in our area, having met with, this was the story relayed to me. They had met with Jay. They had played golf with him on the golf course. And Jay had told them, hey, if I need you to be ears on the ground for me here, if there's things going on that you don't tell me about, we're going to get sideways. Things aren't going to go well. And one of them, I just confirmed with him not long ago, said, yeah, that's exactly what happened. And it was very sort of mob boss kind of thing. Like, we're trying to get control of this region. And you guys are going to be in trouble, whatever that meant.
The control at Mile High Vineyard didn't stop at retaliation. It began much earlier, during the selection and vetting of who would be allowed into leadership. When Mandy Cavoto began exploring a leadership role in the church, she was asked to take what she describes as a strange and invasive test.
Like, we went through their leadership training, which they called EQUIP, right? And basically your homework for EQUIP was to write out your history with authority or sort of confessing character flaws. And then you send it to somebody and they give you a report back. So I have a report where they literally give you a score in these three or four different areas. One of them was like character. One of them was finances. Like, are you a big giver? Another one was kingdom related stuff. Like how, I don't know what the word I'm thinking of, like how spiritually active are you or whatever. So I have like numbers, you know, that rank me. I'm sure they like had everybody's data saved somewhere. And
while some stories from Mile High exposed the church's internal culture and leadership style, others were far more devastating. One of the most sobering accounts came from Heidi Anderson, a longtime member whose family was deeply involved in the church, Her children had grown up attending youth group at Mile High, a place that was supposed to feel like home. But when one of Heidi's sons disclosed abuse to his youth pastor, the response wasn't immediate. The leader sat on the information instead of reporting it, as required by law.
My mind directly went to how is this going to affect my kids? And I was really sure that Cyndia would be charged because she knew names, she knew places, she knew details.
As the months passed, the pain deepened, not just because of what had happened to her child, but because of how the church responded. Heidi discovered that law enforcement wasn't even sure whether the youth leader, Cyndia, would be charged. And when Heidi pressed for accountability, she ran into dismissiveness and denial.
And so, yeah, the sergeant, you know, had told me, like, in the notes, it said that Cyndia was not going to be charged because she was not a mandatory reporter, because she was a volunteer. And I said, she's not a volunteer. She's on staff. That's absolutely not true. And he got a little flustered and he was like, well, you're going to have to talk to Santa Cruz because she's the one that's investigating this. And, you know, you need to talk to her. And so I hung up the phone. A little bit later, the detective Santa Cruz called me back. And, you know, I said, Sergeant Vogel said that you said that she's a volunteer and she's not. And she said, well, we have really specific criteria about who we charge and why we charge them. And for mandatory reporting, you know, she would have to have, like, she's not considered a mandatory reporter. Like her, I think she said her title is a youth group coordinator. And if she had a title like youth group director or like, you know, something more official, then we would charge her. And I was like, okay. And then again, first thing I do is I call Becca and I call Danielle and I'm texting them and telling them this is what the detective said. So I think Cyndi is safe. Okay, great. And then she said, you know, she was going to do some more digging and she would get back to me. And she actually got back to me on the ride home. I will never forget having to get out of the car. Aiden was in the back sleeping and I like got out of the car in the middle of traffic to have this phone conversation because I didn't want him to hear, but I felt like I had to answer because I couldn't wait any longer than I had to. And I just remember realizing that nobody was looking out for my kids' interest because everything she was saying was bullshit. She was saying things like, it sounds like Cyndia told you the day that she found out. And so while she didn't report to the police, like, you know, she did report. And so we're not going to charge her. And I said, that's not true either. Like, what are you talking about? That's not true. And I kept saying, like, I don't care if she's charged, but these are lies. And, you know, she's like, well, we can only go off of what Cyndia reports. And I said, Detective, I gave you evidence that has like timestamps and dates on them of her communicating with my kids days prior to me making a report. Like, that's part of the investigation. Did you not look at those? And, you know, she's like, well, we those aren't things that I looked into. It was clear that she did not do her job.
After Heidi's son disclosed abuse to a trusted youth pastor, it took months for any real accountability to begin. Eventually, that youth leader, Cyndia, was formally charged.
And I don't know, within a couple of days, a day or two, they called back and said that she was going to be issued a summons. And I relayed that information to Becca and Danielle and let them know that she was going to be charged.
But instead of confronting the clear violation of mandatory reporting laws, Mile High Vineyard's leadership under Jay Pathak chose to protect the employee. Rather than acknowledging that Cyndia failed to report abuse as required by law, they doubled down, even paying for her legal defense.
And I looked up that attorney. It is so disgusting. Like on his page, he like advertises all of the cases that he's won. And it's like 2 out of 3 are like sexual assault from a position of power. I'm like, this is who you chose? This is who you wanted to represent you? Gross.
And Cyndia wasn't acting alone. According to Heidi, she had consulted with another leader at Mile High, who told her to wait before reporting the abuse, delaying a response that could have potentially protected others.
So as soon as you guys left, I called Cyndia back and was like, what's up? And she said, I have this secret that I you know, involves you and involves other kids and there's victims involved and I'm trying to figure out what to do, whatever, blah, 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 blah. And she just kept like hinting at it, but she was like, I'm trying to let the victims have a voice. And so next Thursday was the day that the kids all said that they could meet. They want to meet and they want to have a family meeting and I'm going to be there. And I was like, Cyndia, it sounds a lot like you need to report this. It sounds like you know, there's abuse that you're talking about and you don't get to choose when you report that. Like, you have to report it right away. And she was like, well, you know, we're trying to give the victims a voice. We're trying to let the victims use their voice. And I just kept saying, like, no, you can't call a mom. You can't call me. You can't call a mom and say, like, your kid's been abused. Maybe, maybe not. But we have to have a meeting to talk about this and expect that I'm just going to wait until next week. And so we got off the phone. She said, let me talk to Corey. We got off the phone. She called me back and she said, Corey really wants me to wait. Corey was her husband, who was also the pastor of the Arvada Vineyard at the location. And she said, you know, Corey thinks that I need to wait. And I said, Cynthia, no, you're coming over right now. And I actually sent her my brother-in-law's address.
When Heidi and her family pushed for law enforcement and for the church to do the right thing, the resistance only grew. Despite the leadership's insistence that they hadn't been pushed out, Jay Pathick eventually sent an email formally removing the family from the church.
Heidi and Aaron, it is with great sadness that we are sending you this email. It has come to our attention that Heidi has been talking about Cynthia and Corey Garris, two members of our MHB staff, to several people within our church community. Gossip is something that is not taken lightly in our church, especially when it begins to create divisiveness among congregants. In light of this concern, our request is that you refrain from any further conversation regarding the Garris family. We will be issuing a statement to the church about the Garris family, and in order to be transparent, we have attached that statement to this message. Furthermore, regretfully, we feel compromised as a church in our ability to effectively pastor and care for you and your family at this time. While this situation is being processed by all parties, we request that you and your family attend a different church. This includes children attending a different youth group, which we understand will be difficult. With how complex and complicated our relationship has become, we believe that another church community would serve you better right now. It's important to us that your family is in a church where they feel that they are being supported and cared for. Once the situation is resolved, if you would like to return to our church, we would be more than willing to create a plan of reentry. We hope that you can understand the difficult position that MHB and its pastors find ourselves in. We want you and your family to be able to thrive in a church community and believe that it is presently done in another church. Sincerely, Jay Pathick, Becca Newsom, Danielle Pathick.
Even when Jay finally agreed to a meeting years later, Heidi recalls that his apology felt rehearsed, literally.
He said he was
just, you know, step one, I'm sorry for...
It was very patronizing.
Emailing you instead of talking to you in person.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sorry that we weren't, like, prepared for your trauma, which who's prepared for your trauma?
Like, and I clarified, like, what he was apologizing for was for not training Cynthia. And... you know, we all spoke up and said, that's actually not what we want to be apologized for. We can't grant you forgiveness for that because we're not hurt by that. Like, yes, it needed to be fixed. And the next time anything happens, you guys need to do better. But that wasn't the issue. Like, the issue was everything after the fact and the way you guys handled it after the fact that is the problem. And, you know, they seemed surprised about that. But.
And it wasn't just Heidi who saw through it.
And in fact, at the end of the meeting, we come and sit down. And I think our therapist, who, you know, is a person of faith, made a comment. She goes, well, dogs bark, cats meow, and Jay Pathick lies.
Heidi's story is heartbreaking, but it's not isolated. Across multiple accounts from Mile High Vineyard and beyond, a consistent pattern begins to emerge when congregants raise concerns or speak out about harm. First, they're discredited, often labeled as gossips or troublemakers. Then they're gaslit, told their experience isn't what it seemed, or that their pain is a distortion of reality. After that, the institution controls the narrative, privately blaming the victim while publicly avoiding accountability. And finally, those who continue to seek truth or transparency are pushed out entirely. Removed from leadership, removed from community, removed from the story. They're dismissed as unhinged, emotional, or divisive, even when they were simply asking for care, honesty, or justice. What happened to the Andersons reflects a broader truth about Jay Pathick's leadership style. When faced with institutional challenge or personal confrontation, his first instinct has not been to shepherd, but to protect the brand. Even apologies, when offered, come laminated and rehearsed. And behind the curtain of compassion and charisma, one behavior becomes predictable. When the truth becomes inconvenient, the people telling it are shown the door. If what had happened to Heidi Anderson and her family had been an isolated failure, maybe Vineyard USA would have treated it like one. But it wasn't. By the time Heidi's son came forward about abuse, other Vineyard churches across the country had already begun dealing with their own crisis, like Duluth and Anaheim. And yet, rather than respond with deep reflection or a restorative process, the national office moved forward with something else entirely. A top-down restructuring of the entire movement. It was called the Reorg. Framed publicly as a strategic step toward clarity and unity, the Reorg was, in reality, an institutional power shift led by Jay Pathick, a move that centralized authority and reduced the influence of local pastors and congregations. And for those who had just watched stories like Heidi's unfold, it raised an uncomfortable question. Why would a movement facing multiple crises of accountability respond by consolidating more power at the top? In 2021, Jay Pathick officially became National Director of Vineyard USA, taking over leadership at a time when the movement was facing growing disillusionment and public scrutiny. Shortly after stepping into the role, he and his team introduced what they called the Reorg, short for reorganization. According to public statements, it was designed to streamline communication, increase clarity, and better support local churches. But beneath the language of strategy and alignment was a structural shift that would concentrate power at the top of the movement, with Jay and his handpicked national team. The old system, while imperfect, included regional and area leaders who served as a bridge between the national office and local churches. Those leaders were geographically distributed, contextually rooted, and in many cases, pastorally embedded in their communities. The Reorg began to dismantle that intermediary layer. In its place, Vineyard USA proposed a new structure, with direct reporting lines to the national office and fewer mechanisms for local churches to raise concerns or resist central mandates. For those already disillusioned by how Vineyard leadership had handled abuse, accountability, and inclusion, the Reorg didn't feel like a fix. It felt like a takeover. The Reorg didn't emerge in a vacuum. It was introduced just as three major credibility crises were converging in the Vineyard movement. The split with Anaheim Vineyard, after Alan Scott unilaterally pulled the church out of Vineyard USA, the arrest of Jackson Gatlin, a growing outcry about Vineyard USA's failure to act on early warnings from Duluth, and the growing marginalization of pastors who advocated for LGBTQ inclusion, some of whom were quietly removed or publicly sidelined. Rather than stop and listen, reflect, or invite transparency, the national office accelerated a massive internal restructuring process that tightened the reins of authority and quieted dissent. The Reorg was framed as a future-forward strategic evolution, but its timing told another story, a system in damage control mode. As one former Vineyard pastor put it off the record, you don't blow up your organizational map while you're still standing in the rubble unless your goal is to control the cleanup. This wasn't a grassroots response. It wasn't trauma-informed. It was top-down, consultant-driven, and in the eyes of many, opportunistic. Jay Pathick didn't just inherit a crisis, he used it. Before the Reorg, Vineyard operated with a network of local churches that were pastorally and theologically diverse, each with a measure of functional autonomy. The system wasn't perfect, but it offered space for contextual leadership, community discernment, and meaningful feedback from the ground up. The Reorg changed that. Under Jay Pathick's leadership, Vineyard USA introduced a new structure that centralized authority at the national level. In theory, it was about clarity and support. In practice, it meant local churches now answered directly to a national office, one that was increasingly insulated from criticism.
But there was a lot of voices of, let's go back, let's go back, let's go back. And in fact, part of kind of the campaigning of Phil Strout, and you can get this if you go back and listen to his messages he gave when he became national director, which is, let's make Vineyard great again. Let's go back. There was a lot of this back language of a particular kind of thing that Vineyard is that we need to return to. So it was that language of let's go back, let's return, that began to show signs that there was some real strong divisions and that the new regime was going to sort of control making that happen. And that was the in group. And if you weren't in that group, you weren't truly Vineyard.
The new language coming from the national office emphasized alignment and unity. But the practical impact was a demand for agreement. For churches like Reagan's, who had lived out the Vineyard's historic value of local discernment, the shift felt disorienting and silencing.
Thought, well, let's have a conversation about it. And since we're a big tent, let's talk about it. That began to, you know, as I became area pastor and I was attending more national leadership events, and I would hear from the leadership team, we don't talk about that. There was a lot of anger around it, not just around their position, but about the fact that you want to talk about it. And I felt like the sort of locus of control in the Vineyard began to center around people who supported a particular pneumatology, you know, how we view the work, person and work of the Holy Spirit, a particular ecclesiology about who's in and who's out and how this structure could work. And if you played within that system, there was a seat at the table for you. And if you didn't, there wasn't. And what I began to see, because of the intolerance of the ability to ask questions, is that that became about consolidation of power and about control. And very good friends of mine who were asking very sincere questions faced very hard harsh rebukes from the movement for asking those questions. And that was my experience too.
Instead of support, churches with questions about theology, justice, or accountability were met with suspicion or even rebuke. The reorg didn't just rewrite the flowchart. It redefined what it meant to belong. And for churches who had experienced trauma or spoken truth to power, it confirmed what they feared. This wasn't about empowering local leaders. It was about consolidating control. To justify the reorg, Vineyard USA pointed to a 2022 document titled Discerning Vineyard Ordination, Local Leader Feedback Report. It was presented as the result of wide consultation, a sign that the leadership overhaul had emerged from prayerful consensus. But a deeper look tells a very different story. A methodological critique of the survey revealed multiple red flags that call its legitimacy into question. Among the most troubling, incomplete data collection. Vineyard USA ended the survey process before all area meetings had concluded, leading to a partial and unbalanced data set. Unknown response rate. The report failed to disclose how many people were invited to participate, or how many declined, making the data impossible to verify for representativeness. Theologically loaded questions. Many prompts were worded in ways that subtly pressured respondents to align with a predetermined direction. Truncated and redacted quotes. Quotations in the report were often partial, redacted, or stripped of context, raising serious concerns about transparency. Over-thematicization without raw counts. Themes were reported as percentages, but the underlying data, confidence intervals, and actual counts were never disclosed. Lack of reliability measures. No inter-rater reliability was reported, and initial coding was performed by just two Vineyard staff members. No regional weighting. The survey failed to adjust for high response or low response regions, skewing the findings towards areas where participation was highest. Conflict of interest. Perhaps most critically, the independent consultant who helped code and analyze the data was a member of Vineyard Columbus, the same church where Jay Pathak previously served and remained closely connected. In short, Vineyard USA used a flawed, non-transparent, and potentially biased survey to justify a complete restructuring of power, all while claiming the changes reflected the will of the movement. There was no independent verification of the findings, no external audit, and no evidence that critical voices were meaningfully included. Instead, Vineyard USA treated the survey as if it carried democratic legitimacy, when in fact, it functioned more like a rubber stamp for decisions already made behind closed doors. One of the most consistent patterns in the Vineyard movement, whether at the local or national level, has been the strategic management of public perception. And the reorg was no exception. From the beginning, questions and concerns were framed as obstacles to unity. Pastors who voiced hesitation were labeled as resistant, overly emotional, or not aligned. Rather than engage the tension, leadership sought to neutralize it. The reorg wasn't rolled out with dialogue. It was announced with inevitability. Reagan Wegener, who raised questions both publicly and directly with Vineyard USA leadership, experienced this dynamic firsthand. In some cases, pastors who raised objections found themselves removed from leadership pipelines, ignored in official communications, or gradually cut off from denominational relationships. This pattern wasn't new. It mirrored what we heard from Heidi Anderson, who was formally removed from Mile High Vineyard after raising concerns about mishandled abuse, Mandy Cavoto, who was told she was emotionally unfit for leadership after expressing burnout, LGBTQ-affirming pastors, who were slowly sidelined despite their ongoing contributions to Vineyard churches. In every case, the response was the same. Discredit the person, control the narrative, protect the brand. Vineyard USA talked often about health and alignment, but rarely about repentance or repair. And the reorg, rather than being a moment of institutional reckoning, became an exercise in tightening the message. In the Vineyard playbook, dissent wasn't evidence of needed growth. It was evidence of your disloyalty. Throughout this chapter, we've traced a consistent pattern in how Jay Pathick and Vineyard USA responded to dissent. Suppressing critical voices, reframing legitimate concern as gossip or rebellion, consolidating control in the name of clarity, punishing those who didn't align, and carefully managing language to avoid transparency while maintaining brand trust. On their own, these behaviors are troubling. But taken together, they raise a larger question. What happens when a religious movement stops being a community and starts acting like a system of control? To explore that question, we compared Vineyard USA's leadership culture against recognized frameworks for cultic behavior, including the criteria developed by Dr. Robert Lifton, who studied thought reform and authoritarian systems, the International Cultic Studies Association, or ICSA, and licensed therapists and sociologists who specialize in high-control religious environments. What we found was unsettling. Vineyard USA under the reorg showed marked overlap with several of Lifton's characteristics. Milieu control, restricting information and communication within the movement. Sacred science, reframing leadership decisions as divinely ordained and beyond question. Loading the language, replacing transparent conversation with spiritual jargon like alignment, covering, and submission. Doctrine over person, and validating real harm by claiming institutional health is the highest good. And demand for purity, labeling dissenters as divisive, rebellious, or emotionally unstable. We also found Vineyard USA's behavior aligned with several items from the ICSA's checklist of cult characteristics, including unquestioning loyalty to leadership, use of shame to control behavior, exclusivity, we are the only ones doing it right, lack of meaningful input from members, punishment or shunning of those who leave. Multiple people we spoke with, including former pastors, longtime volunteers, and lay leaders, used the word cult without prompting. This doesn't mean every Vineyard church operates like a cult. It doesn't mean every leader is abusive. But it does mean that the system, as currently structured, shows clear signs of high control dynamics, especially when accountability is demanded. And as we've seen from Heidi Anderson's family, from pastors pushed out for asking questions, and from the silent trauma echoing through dozens of churches, when spiritual language is used to enforce loyalty and suppress truth, you don't need robes and Kool-Aid to call it what it is. Vineyard USA didn't create the crisis that unfolded in Duluth and Anaheim, but it did use them. As survivor accounts, investigative reports, and public outrage began to ripple through the movement, national leadership saw a moment of institutional vulnerability. And instead of using that moment to listen and repent, they used it to reorganize on their terms. It wasn't just the headlines they leveraged. It was also a growing internal narrative of existential decline. As far back as 2020, a confidential reorg memo outlined deep structural concerns within Vineyard, an aging base of pastors, a plateau in church planting, and a lack of theological clarity. But the solutions it proposed weren't collaborative or restorative, they were centralizing. Fast forward to 2022 to 2023. The Guidepost Solutions Organizational Assessment was commissioned, supposedly to help make sense of the crisis. But the assessment was tightly scoped, explicitly excluding spiritual abuse, financial issues, and systemic misconduct. And the lead investigator, according to multiple sources, was financially dependent on the work, facing immense personal pressure due to his wife's declining health. When a process is shaped by limits, dependency, and fear, it rarely surfaces truth. It surfaces exactly what leadership wants to hear. And what it heard, remarkably, almost perfectly mirrored the 2020 reorg memo. A side-by-side comparison shows that the issues Guidepost discovered were already outlined 3 years earlier, including the overreach and impossibility of the national director role, the lack of formal structures for accountability, the dysfunction of a volunteer-led executive team, and the theological and demographic fragility of the movement itself. It's hard not to see the Guidepost report as confirmation bias wrapped in the language of reform. Then came the flawed ordination survey, leading questions, biased framing, vague conclusions. And critically, it was interpreted and coded in part by a member of Vineyard Columbus, the same church Jay Pathak once attended. Together, these tools, the memo, the assessment, and the survey, formed the perfect trifecta: a perceived theological crisis, a real abuse scandal, and a manipulated discernment process that gave the appearance of consent. It worked. The reorg moved forward with almost no real collaboration, despite the fact that many pastors agreed change was desperately needed. But need for change isn't the same as consent to authoritarianism, and trauma should never be used as a Trojan horse for power. We've spent this chapter unpacking the rise of Jay Pathak, the flawed reorg, and the patterns of coercion, control, and concealment that have defined Vineyard USA's recent years. And in this last section, we laid bare how a perfect storm of crisis, manufactured, manipulated, and real, was leveraged to push through a sweeping consolidation of power. Not with transparency, not with collaboration, but with strategy. Many pastors believed change was needed. Few would say this is how it should have happened. Next week, we return for the final chapter of Season 1 of Spoiled Fruit, Faith and Power. But this story isn't ending. Every week, more people come forward with stories. Some echo what we've already explored. Others hint at abuses and cover-ups we haven't yet touched. And so, Season 2 is almost inevitable. Because what we've uncovered is not the whole story. It's just the part that's finally being told. In our Season 1 finale, we'll step back and look at the structure, not just the symptoms. We'll show how Vineyard's governance model, leadership culture, and lack of accountability mechanisms created the perfect environment for harm. And then, we'll offer concrete solutions. Structural reforms, reporting systems, oversight practices, and the spiritual humility required to implement them. Because this isn't just about critique, it's about repair. And the only question left is, will they choose it? Thank you for listening to this episode of Spoiled Fruit, Faith and Power. We want to offer our deepest thanks to Mandy Cavoto, the Anderson family, and Reagan Wagoner for bravely sharing their stories and trusting us with the truth. Their courage and the courage of so many others is what makes this work possible. This podcast is produced by John Williamson Productions, LLC. The views expressed are those of the participants and host and do not represent any official organization. All efforts have been made to verify the accuracy of the information presented. Listeners are encouraged to approach this material with discernment and to consult source materials and public records where available. The content of this podcast may include allegations, statements of opinion, and interpretations based on available information, interviews, and public documentation. All individuals mentioned are presumed innocent unless proven otherwise in a court of law. If you or someone you know has experienced abuse or harm in a religious context, we encourage you to seek support. Resources can be found on our website. Next week marks the final episode of Season 1. We'll examine the deeper structural and cultural issues that enable the patterns of abuse we've documented and offer practical, systemic solutions that Vineyard USA could implement today if it truly chose accountability over image. Until then, we thank you for listening, for sharing, and refusing to look away.